The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
During this period, I'm going to offer a taste show, a Dharma talk. So this is also a period of formal practice. We sit upright and unmoving, receiving the words. And we don't have to spend too much time trying to remember or understand, but noticing the effect that these words might be having on you as you sit in Zazen. Case one from the Blue Cliff Record. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" Bodhidharma said, "Empty, without holiness." The emperor said, "Who is facing me?" Bodhidharma replied, "I don't know." The emperor did not understand. After this, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei. Later, the emperor brought this up to Master Ji and asked him about it. Master Ji asked, "Does your majesty know who this man is?" The emperor said, "I don't know." Master Ji said, "He is the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the Buddha mind seal." The emperor felt regretful, so he wanted to send an emissary to go invite Bodhidharma to return. Master Ji told him, "Your majesty, don't say that you will send someone to fetch him back, even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him. He still wouldn't return." So I want to say a little bit about this koan and koan practice in general, and also why we picked this koan for this particular sesshin. One of the things about receiving or hearing a koan is that often these dialogues or stories or various ways of presenting the Dharma are not easily understood by the discursive mind, by the thinking mind, which is one of the reasons why I directed us all to receive the words that I'm speaking in your heart mind. As we talked about last night, the body, the heart, the thinking mind are really all one thing. But we tend to focus on one more than the other. And many of us focus on thinking, on trying to figure things out. David and I have been doing a bit of research into Bodhidharma, one of the great masters of the Zen tradition, revered for centuries. He lived probably in the 6th century. He was Indian. He came to China at the request of his own teacher to teach the people in China who were already practicing Buddhism the way of Zen practice, which, according to one of the only writings that we maybe believe that Bodhidharma wrote, he's a very legendary character. We don't know. There's a lot of stories about him that have entered the mythology of China and then traveled to Japan and other Buddhist countries into the West. But he did write this one text, we think, maybe called The Outline of Practice. And David and I are going to teach something about this and explore this text in our Buddhism 101 class, which will be coming up in a few weeks. So we've been intrigued by what we do know about Bodhidharma. As I said, we don't know much about him. In Zen's Chinese Heritage, the translator Andy Ferguson calls Bodhidharma one of the great legendary teachers, the legendary period. And it's partly because 500 AD is a long time ago. And many of the things that were written about Bodhidharma weren't written for hundreds and hundreds of years. And certainly the tales told about Bodhidharma came even later, but have been accepted so much that we see Bodhidharma's figure in various places in all Buddhist countries, certainly in Mahayana, great vehicle countries, like China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and the West. And he's usually depicted as having a very serious face. In Japan, he's called Daruma, and there are dolls with Bodhidharma's face on them. They're called Daruma dolls, and they have a rounded bottom so that when you tip them, they roll around for a little while and then come back to center, which is a nice metaphor for how it is to practice Zen. We keep moving in our minds. We try not to move in our bodies, but sometimes we can't even help that. But eventually we come to a centered place, a place that is not static or stiff, because like the Daruma dolls with their rounded bottoms, anything can set us off, moving back and forth and side to side, moving around in our minds, making associations, as Madhu brought up last night with the beautiful association to the tree on the hill. We don't know why these associations happen, but we begin to learn to trust that the mind simply moves. The heart moves. And of course, the body moves. Even though we're upright and still, we're breathing. The breath enters the body and leaves the body. The heart pumps, the physical heart pumps the blood around the veins. There's a lot of action going on inside our bodies. So this relative stillness is so important because it helps us to remember, to keep coming back to the still point, the center place, the middle of all of our experience. So not too stiff, not too loose either. We find this middle way through our practice of Zazen, of sitting meditation. And Bodhidharma taught in his outline of practice that this is the way to understand the principle of Zen through the practice of sitting meditation itself. He himself, after he left the emperor in this little dialogue that's been carried down for all these centuries, may or may not have happened, perhaps not, but it doesn't matter, partly because the principles involved in the misunderstanding between the emperor and Bodhidharma have resonated through the centuries to this present moment when we ask the question, what is Zen practice? What is going on? Bodhidharma famously said in his outline of practice that one way, the way of principle, is to trust completely that you already have the Buddha nature. You're already perfect and complete as you are, which includes all the things that we would like to cut away or reject. We would like to think, oh, this couldn't be it. When I get frustrated or irritated, when I say things that I don't mean, when I hurt people. Also, we say that these things are the Buddha nature, the nature of awakening. Buddha is just a Pali or a Sanskrit word that means the one who's awake. The awakened heart mind, we sometimes say, the awakened core of our being, the fundamental ground. Zen teachers talk about this in all kinds of ways, but the teaching keeps pointing to the same thing, already here. Already done. And I'm sure you've heard all of the teachers in Boundless Way when we give talks, we refer back to this in our own style and our own through our own experience and personalities. But it's the same teaching already here. Then why? Why do we have to practice if we're already Buddhas? And we say that we can't just sit by the side of the road and wait to return to our true home. We have to get up and move. Dogen, our ancestor who lived in the 13th century, so long after Bodhidharma lived in Japan, He asked the same question. If we're already awakened beings, why do we have to practice? And in order to find the answer to that question, he traveled to China to study with Zen masters there. So we say sometimes, why did Bodhidharma come from the West, from India? Why did Dogen go to China? Why do we come to sit together in this concentrated fashion for 3 days? Not many days in the course of the many, many days of our lives, but significant days. Days when we have decided, as we so movingly discussed last night, the reasons that we come for this are hard to say in words, and yet we all found ways to speak them. Why did Dogen go to China? Why did Bodhidharma go from India to China? We might say China is the place where we practice. I only mean that metaphorically. Right here is the place we practice. When Alan suggested that we do one thing at a time, and then I repeated that this morning as we moved from our formal practice to our informal practice, this is another way of understanding this, to really, really engage with what is right here, knowing that it is everything. And so Bodhidharma, in his instructions from his own teacher in India, was told that he must bring this teaching to China, where there was already Buddhism. And the wonderful thing about this story, and the wonderful thing about koans in general, especially the ones where there are many characters involved, many people, many personalities, is that we are challenged when we hear these stories to notice who we identify with and who seems really off the mark. Those people, Emperor Wu, so deluded, we might think, and Bodhidharma, wow, so profound. Or we may think, what is Bodhidharma talking about? I'm with Emperor Wu. And then there's this teacher, Master Ji, who is definitely legendary because he lived at a different time than Wu or Bodhidharma, but he figures in the story. Somebody put this story together. Three very different people trying to find their way to that still point in their own way and offering us teachings which have resonated through the centuries. I'm struck that this particular story, this koan story, comes at the very beginning of one of our koan collections that we use in Boundless Way, the Blue Cliff Record, the very first one. And later in another collection called the Book of Serenity or the Book of Equanimity, this koan appears in the second koan, the second place in the collection, although without the little dialogue with Master Ji and the Emperor, just a shorter version which ends with Bodhidharma saying, "I don't know," to the Emperor when he's asked who he is. So these different parts of the koan, we can really look and see, how do we understand these people? And this is a training in becoming, in actualizing, I might say, our true nature as bodhisattvas. Bodhidharma and bodhisattva share the first word together, bodhi meaning wisdom, or really the Buddha nature again. Bodhisattva means a being. And one of the big differences between Indian Buddhism and what came to be called the Mahayana, although Mahayana arose in India originally, but really flourished in China and became the Zen school in China. Lots of different histories about this, which say different things. But we understand, and I really believe, that the flourishing of the Mahayana, which means great vehicle, that is the vehicle, the container, the embrace of the teachings that is so big that it embraces everyone with no exception. This teaching that everyone has the Buddha nature. So Hakuin, many centuries later in the 16th, 17th centuries, says all beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. We are already Buddhas, but we don't realize it. So we have to go somewhere. Dogen had to go to China. Bodhidharma had to go to China. All of us have to find our way to this understanding, but not through the intellect, not through figuring it out, but through realizing it, being awake to it in our own practice, and recognizing it not only in ourselves, but in others. Again, the part of the delight of koan practice is identifying with the different characters, as I said. You might say that it, here in Boundless Way, where we have five transmitted teachers, six transmitted teachers, and three senior assistant teachers, and four more assistant teachers, all people giving talks, all with very different personalities. And yet the Dharma comes through no matter who is speaking. The Dharma comes through, as I said, through character, through personality, through history. And sometimes a talk that we hear from a teacher will really resonate. We'll say, yes, yes, that's what I feel too. That's what I think. That's what I know. And other times just goes right over our heads, right around us, avoids us entirely. The same thing with these stories. This is a training in being empathic, in being sympathetic, in understanding that all human beings are different from each other, unique in our own ways, and yet we all have the Buddha nature. So the Emperor Wu was quite famous for being one of the first, maybe the first, Buddhist emperors. In fact, he got so serious about practicing Buddhism, as he understood it from reading about it in many of the Indian sutras, that he started to ignore things that he needed to do as a politician. He ended up living in a bare room. He renounced eating meat and having relations with his wife. Well, actually, she had died earlier anyway, but he became celibate. He took on the precepts of the Theravada, the original teachings of the Buddha. And he was very serious about spreading this teaching throughout his kingdom, the kingdom of Wu. Up north in China, there was another kingdom, a different emperor, and that is where Bodhidharma ended up living his life, in a monastery that he founded at what's now called the Shaolin Temple. After he left the emperor, he legendarily, again, faced the wall for 9 years until his first students began to appear. He was very unconventional, this Bodhidharma, and in a way, so was Emperor Wu. What a radical thing to do in a country where Buddhism was really new and fresh. He built temples, and he ordained people. He created many places where people could ordain, so-called ordination platforms, so that other people could open themselves, open their hearts, really, to the teachings of the Buddha, who had already lived 2,000 years before the Emperor Wu, before Bodhidharma. So long ago, if you think back 2,000 years in our Western culture, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? That's when Jesus walked the earth, perhaps. And we don't really know that much about what happened 2,000 years ago, and neither did Emperor Wu, but he did his best to create a Buddhist country, the kingdom of Liang, it was called. And so Emperor Wu was so excited. You can imagine his excitement to meet a true teacher of the way, not somebody that he read about in books or sutras, not the people who were teaching those things in his own country, but someone from the source country, from India, who had made this long journey to come to see him, and according to this legend, showed up at the court. And before this koan begins, there's a very long dialogue between the emperor and Bodhidharma about the merit that the emperor would have attained through doing all these things, through becoming Buddhist, through ordaining, through study, through founding temples, through making it possible for other people to study and ordain. Because there is this concept, and Corwin mentioned it briefly last night when he was talking about our giving merit to people who are suffering, remembering them in our chanting. This idea that that all the things we do have cumulative impact, positive cumulative impact on the world, and that that comes back to us. We benefit from that merit. And before this story starts, after the emperor told Bodhidharma all the wonderful things he'd done, he asked, how much merit do I get? And Bodhidharma said, no merit whatsoever. And they had a longer dialogue about this, where the emperor really tried to understand, how could this be? And isn't it true, so many of us maybe do this practice with some kind of gaining idea? Maybe not merit, because that idea is not so prevalent in our culture, but maybe it is. If I do a good deed, then good things will happen to me. Although, if we really look at the law of cause and effect, that doesn't seem to be so true. I may do wonderful things, and yet still, I get old and sick and die. These things are of our nature. There's no way to avoid them, as we say in the Five Remembrances. So what's it all about? Why am I doing all this? Well, to get enlightened, maybe that's what we're thinking we should do. And we have some very strange, I have to say, concepts of what enlightenment is, and we let them blind us. We become deluded by all of our ideas about merit, enlightenment, some goal we have, some really fixed sense of the way things should be. If I practice hard enough, I will. And then we fill in the blank with, in the emperor's case, merit. And in many of our cases, I won't have any problems anymore. Everything will be okay. The world will suddenly right itself, and there'll be no more suffering. Whatever your particular story is, it's important to know what that is. And part of this story with Bodhidharma and the emperor is the emperor learning a little bit about his own delusion. In the koan, all of that stuff about merit is passed by. That's the history behind the beginning, because the teaching that Bodhidharma has to give to us, and also to the emperor in this case, is about two very important points about our Zen practice, which Bodhidharma later wrote about in his Outline of Practice. Two things that are hard to understand, but that when we sit with them, they begin to open up to us. When we do formal work on this koan, if we happen to be koan students, we maybe ask lots of questions about the meaning of Bodhidharma's ancestors, responses of Bodhidharma's responses to the emperor's questions. What is Zen? What is Buddhism? And Bodhidharma's famous response, vast emptiness with nothing holy in it. Emperor Wu, of course, venerated the sutras and venerated the history of Buddhism that he knew about and considered the teachings holy, special, better than ordinary life in a way, something to aspire to. And we may find ourselves doing that very same thing. But Bodhidharma said they're not holy. And later talked about, and many Zen teachers have talked about, the mistake we make by making a division between the holy and the non-holy, the ordinary and the special. If everyone truly is a Buddha already, and that every act of ours is the action of a Buddha, then there's no real difference between good and bad, right and wrong, holiness and non-holiness. And in fact, this non-holiness resides in a huge space that Bodhidharma called emptiness or thusness. He probably used the Indian word, the Sanskrit word shunyata, vastness. Nowhere to land. Nowhere to say, I've got it. I know what it is now. I've pinned it down. Thank you. Now I'll go off and do something else. This is the great vast mystery. Vastness is another word that's sometimes used to describe it, or some teachers call it the mystery, the openness of experience where nothing stays static, nothing is pinned down. All of our ideas about shunyata, thusness, emptiness, whatever it is, fall apart in the actual experience of thusness, which is sometimes called the experience of awakening, because we awaken to our Buddha nature in those moments. Things drop away. And in that place, there's nothing holy. What a thing to say to this really well-meaning emperor who had done so much to promote Buddhism in his own country. But he was lost in a deluded idea. And so we can identify with Emperor Wu. We can identify with him as a person just like us who continually creates stories about Zen, Buddhism, practice, enlightenment, whatever, and ultimately is thrown back on our own practice, whether it's breath practice, whether it's just sitting practice, working with a koan or an inquiry that we've been assigned by a teacher, whatever it is. All of these practices are skillful means, upaya in Sanskrit, skillful means that point us in the direction of nowhere, nothing, nada, 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 as St. John of the Cross said. This amazing experience of dropping away. Sounds great if you haven't experienced it. When it does happen, probably the mind will rush in and maybe even say, oh, this is probably what they were talking about. And again, you can see how quickly minds will make these stories, these confined, limited, narrow versions of the vastness. And one of the reasons we practice is, and I really believe this with all my heart, that everyone has had an experience of this opening, but because the mind is so quick to create a story about it, we forget about it or we distort it, and it becomes another block in our awakening journey. And it really is a journey of awakening. All these people taking their long trips, it took Bodhidharma, according to the legend, 3 years to go from India to China. Dogen crossed the sea from Japan to China. Everything we did to get here right now in this moment, so complex to set aside the time to find a way to care for the things that need to be cared for so that we can devote ourselves to this simple, straightforward practice of being still and upright. It's effort to do this. It takes something. We can't just, as I said earlier, sit by the side of the road and wait. And yet this is what we're doing. We are sitting in the full presence of the awakened heart, mind, body. And it reveals itself to us when we stop interfering with its presence. Zazen is a technology, somebody said last night, maybe it was David Roshi, a technology for awakening to this vast emptiness with nothing holy in it. And then, of course, the emperor is startled by this. And he says, who are you standing here before me? This is not the teaching that he's received from the Indian tradition, from the sutras and texts that he's been studying. And Bodhidharma famously says, I don't know. The Chinese for this phrase is the two words, not knowing, no, or no knowing. The same no that we use in the koan, mu or wu. this knot? How can we, in this vast emptiness, pin down the self to our history, even to our actions, to our characters and personalities? When we really look, when we really try to find the self, we can only find things that are temporary, that are not the true nature of a human being. And this is where this not knowing, this no knowing of Bodhidharma is so precious. Vast emptiness with nothing holy in it and no knowing. And then of course he leaves, he goes up north to the Kingdom of Wei, where he finds his cave where he sits and faces the wall. That's another story. But meanwhile, in this version of the story, one of the people who is the emperor's counselors, who is a Buddhist priest himself, asks the emperor if he knows who that was who just left. And did you understand what he said? And the emperor didn't understand. And he doesn't know who he was. And the counselor, the priest G, says he was the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. He was, in a less fancy way of saying it, the embodiment of compassion, coming all the way from India to reveal his teachings to you. And of course, the emperor's upset about this. He missed it. He didn't use this amazing opportunity, this opportunity to meet with a living teacher, which we try to replicate in Boundless Way by offering Doksan, by offering meetings with teachers. And he says, let's get him back. I missed it, but I want to try again. And G says, no matter what you do, you can't get him back. He'll never return. And this is one of the reasons, in my view, that we keep accentuating the power of waking up to whatever's here in the present moment, because these opportunities, as we'll hear from the ghost tonight, who will speak to us from beyond the grave and tell us that opportunity is lost. Don't lose the opportunity. Right now, in this moment, the air is coming into this room with an amazing freshness. The winds are blowing. A storm is coming from the southwest. A mourning dove is calling. All the teachings we need come from that mourning dove, come from the feeling of the wind on our own bodies. All of it is here already. And the only way we can not miss the opportunity is to practice being awake to what's here right now. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? Bodhidharma said, empty, without holiness. The emperor said, who is facing me? Bodhidharma replied, I don't know. The emperor did not understand. After this, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the Kingdom of Wei. Later, the emperor brought this up to Master Ji and asked him about it. Master Ji asked, does your majesty know who this man is? The emperor said, I don't know. Master Ji said, he is the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the Buddha mind seal. The emperor felt regretful, so he wanted to send an emissary to go invite Bodhidharma to return. Master Ji told him, your majesty, don't say that you will send someone to fetch him back, even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him. He still wouldn't return. Thank you. And please make yourselves comfortable, adjust your posture. We're going to have what we call a Dharma dialogue, and this is where hopefully as many of you as possible will raise your hand and come forward, and I'll call on you, Alan, And David and I will do our best to respond to your comments and questions. And this is really an opportunity to show up from your own experience. Don't think that you don't know anything. You know everything about what it means to be you, or maybe you're beginning to suspect a little bit of what it means to be you. So this is a contribution from your own heart, mind, and body to all of the other hearts and minds and bodies that are on screen with us right now. The way this will work is you just raise your Zoom hand when you have a comment or a question, and I'll call on you, and then we might or might not respond to you. So please, who will go first? Madhu.
Yeah, so many entry points in your talk. I'm like, which one should I choose? That's going to be beneficial for everybody here.
Just choose one that's beneficial for you.
Okay. So I'll just share something that, you know, the Bodhidharma's confusion or dilemma about, you know, I also encounter people asking me this question when some of my friends know that I'm a Zen practitioner. And whenever sometimes I, you know, meet with them, they ask me like, what level are you at? What level are you at? And then, you know, my response usually is that, oh, in Zen, we don't have levels. There's just one level, and this is here and now. That's the only level that I know of. And, you know, once one of my friends started going on and on about, you know, how there are different levels, and yeah, and I was like, okay, so you don't get it. And again, another friend asked me the same question, what level are you at? And the only answer I know is the same answer. So that's what I said. There is just this, just this. Whatever is here now, this is the only level. And yeah, so, but I'm also noticing that sometimes people do need to understand the holiness of the person or the situation to enter that, right? Like, because, you know, if the emperor, if Xi wouldn't have stepped in and told him that, yeah, he's this, you know, a bodhisattva and, you know, this great being, then he probably would not have understood the significance of the moment, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, so all these complexities that I'm noticing, that all these associations and all this, you know, integration of form and emptiness, sometimes, you know, the response is emptiness, and sometimes it's more like, you know, entering through form. And yeah, so all this.
Well, I think you just named it. Sometimes it's like this and sometimes it's like that, because it's true that we regard everyone as equal in Buddha nature. It's really true. And there are different levels of understanding. You know, so I'm a Roshi, which means an old teacher, and we have made you an assistant teacher. But I don't recommend telling that to people, you know, who are seeking that sort of thing. You have to kind of figure out, what does this person need to know? And it sounds like you going in that one direction of it's all the same is helpful maybe for those people. But maybe, you know, right now we're saying both are true. They're both true. There are people who really don't get it, and there are people who really get it, and everything in between. And also, we move in and out of getting it and not getting it. That's the other thing. It's not a static thing. So rank sometimes feels like it would be static, but it's not. Every morning we have to wake up and say, now what? I don't know. That's what I say. Alan or David, do you have something? Or maybe.
Yeah, I love the koan about another of our great Chinese teachers, Lin Ji, who says to his monks, you know, I see every once in a while, I see looking out of the face of each one of you, a person of no rank. And I felt Madhu was gesturing towards that, the person of no rank. And so, yeah, we have our, you know, Roshis and senseis and Dharma holders and et cetera. And we are all persons of no rank. And that's that other side of it that you pointed to. But I really appreciate, Madhu, the way that you brought that forward. And you know, I'm tempted to get stuck in that. And so also listening to Melissa is helping me realize. And, for teaching purposes, we do have these levels. But and I too wouldn't do not tell anyone outside of Boundless Way Zen that I'm a sensei.
Yeah, bad idea.
Thank you. Steve.
I came to the Sesshin with this very specific idea that I was going to work on this problem that I had that came up during koan practice about my mind being the sort of the thing that I dealt with everything with. And then since the beginning of the Sesshin, which is not really that much, an entirely different image of what I'm doing has come in to my head, and it was reinforced by your talk, which is that if I consider my life a symphony, the theme of dealing with the problem of having both a head and a heart is not a problem. It's part of the symphony that keeps coming up and getting back woven back into the thing, and then moves forward and comes up again. And one of the things that came up in your talk was thinking about the Emperor Wu wanting to call Bodhidharma back, and the counselor saying to him, "You can't do that." I thought, well, of course you can't do that. The symphony has moved on. The moment of that happening has happened, and now something else is going to happen.
Yeah, Steve, appreciate you mentioning that what we come and what we think we're working on is just a tiny part. May prove to be true, may not be true, but I love this image of the symphony and what is the best part of the symphony? Well, it's this moment right here, and this possibility of appreciating that. So it's not about trying to solve some problem. In fact, your problems are not your problems. They are your life, right? And as we meet them and see them, John Tarrant used to say, let the koan work on the koan. Let your problem work on your problem. There's something so precious right here that's not different from anything other than this. Yeah.
There's a man who has spent a good part of his life making music visual, and you can see on YouTube his visualizations of many different kinds of music. And the way he manages it is there is a line in the middle of the screen, and then coming in from the right are bars of color and different shapes and things. And as they get to the line, they become sound, and then they go off to the left and disappear. So you always are centered on the moment, but you appreciate all of the complexity that's coming into the moment and what's left behind.
Yeah, this moment includes all of that. Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Reverend Jenny.
Thank you for the talk, Melissa. And I was especially glad to get a teaser for Buddhism 101 and excited about that just because of my own preference for the Chinese sources over the Pali sources. And that's exciting. And I love the story in the koan about Bodhidharma meeting the emperor. And when I hear, vast emptiness, nothing holy. So I have to personally translate that for myself as nothing holier than anything else, or everything holy equally. Yeah. And emptiness, I still have a problem with that word that seems so important in all of our texts and and practice and everything, and I appreciated like vastness rather than vastness. And I love to hear alternatives to that word because it's not the only translation. And yeah, and shunyata is, I mean, it's nice because it's because it is foreign, so I'm not saying this is exactly what it is if I translate it, but then I feel reluctant to use that too because it's a foreign word that I don't really know the meaning of. But yeah, just really appreciated your telling of the story
I appreciate everything you're saying, Jenny, so much, because you're really demonstrating how we have to enter these talks and these stories. Just what I was pointing to, really. This is not some abstract piece of information. This is like, wait a minute, what? Like, that should be a very common response. And then tasting, going into how does this work? And of course, words are pointers, and they're also the thing itself. So when we have a word translated that just doesn't do it for us, sometimes that can be an entry point. Just the resistance to a word, resistance itself can be an entry point. And I know somebody helped me many decades ago with my own confusion about emptiness. Oh, I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh, by saying that you always have to add the word of afterwards. It's emptiness of something. So emptiness of fixed forms, empty of a personality, empty of a self, you know, empty of whatever, staticness. You can just, that's another way of playing with that word in English. Yeah, and it was interesting. He, you know, native Vietnamese speaker, second language was French and then English. So he taught in English when I met him, and he was very clear that these words were not the thing itself, but they were the vehicle that the teachings were being carried on. So he wanted people to understand what might have been meant by them. And it was very inspiring at the time. Yeah. Thank you.
Also, Jenny, going back to where you began, no holiness, nothing holy means nothing unholy. And I think that's so important because there are religious traditions that are really invested in dividing things between the sacred and profane, the holy and the unholy, the pure and the impure, and Bodhidharma refuses to do that. And kind of, I think he sees in Emperor Wu someone who's invested in a certain idea of holiness, and the kindest thing he can do is to take that away.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think a word I struggle with is purity or purify, because that comes up in a lot of, especially Pali texts and older texts, but also in Zen, there are people who cling to the idea of purifying, that I'm going to get to the empty place. I mean, when I read about Emperor Wu getting rid of all his stuff and living in a bare room, you know, just sleeping on the floor, I thought, oh, there it is again, the misunderstanding of a word and then making it into the whole thing itself without adding in all the different variations and colors of these words, and how not holy, not holy, right? Not pure, not impure, and also pure and impure, and holy and not holy. It's all of it together. So yeah, thank you. Yeah, let's move on to Beverly.
Thank you, Melissa, for your talk. So it's been interesting to hear the different comments from other people. I've heard the koan before, and maybe there are things I didn't hear this time in your talk, because it's such a it has such an impact on me that I think I just sort of stop listening and get caught up in what's going on inside. I definitely identify with the emperor, and I think it's just one of the most depressing stories I've ever heard. I mean, it really makes me feel hopeless. And so that's why I was interested in other people's ideas or thoughts. And maybe I wouldn't have raised my hand if I'd heard that. But anyway, it just it's really a koan that makes me feel despair.
Can you say more about this hopelessness and despair? I think that would be really helpful and instructive. Other people who might be feeling something similar.
So maybe that's where I missed some parts, but anyway, the fact that the emperor he didn't see who it was, and then it was finished. And this breaks my heart. I mean, it's like, no, how can that be? That's the despair, because the story tells us that he never came back, right? I mean, so I mean, I know it's bigger than that. It's got to be, but there's this, the way that story hits me, it's, yeah.
And so these are stories about human life, human nature. And there is a truth that there are moments in our life and things happen, and afterwards we can feel profound regret. Oh my goodness, this happened, and in that moment my life shifted. We would like to, can I have a do-over? Even something I said that wasn't skillful. I resonated too in listening this time to the emperor felt great regret. Sometimes that is how we feel as human beings, right? This regret. Bodhidharma, I think, is pointing the emperor, as Alan said, very kindly. And so it's not about having a do-over with Bodhidharma, right? So the emperor, we can think, oh, I missed it, and my life is ruined, or my life is this, or my life is that. That's just a story. There is this kind of beyond the one and the many, beyond right and wrong. And where is that? Where is Bodhidharma right now? If you think he's in China, or if you think he's somewhere else, then we're missing the point. So all of this, the regret, and some kind of wild possibility that we may get or we may not get, or sometimes we get it, and sometimes I'm just hopeless. I know I'll never. All of this, in a sense, is the field that arises as we practice. And so, how to cry the tears of longing. I'm sure I'll never understand this because I'm such a, or whatever. All of this is part of it.
And I think I love what you're both saying, actually. There's something about the hopelessness being the Dharma gate, the despair. Like, if I didn't know, if I make a mistake, and then, the story seems to collapse for me. And I've been thinking about, this hasn't happened to me, but I know a lot of us have had divorces well, this has happened to me, relationships that didn't go anywhere and ended poorly, and of course we've lost people who've died. There's a certain way that the mind sometimes shuts down at the endings of relationship, where we say, that's it, I'm never going to do it again, I'm not going to open my heart, I'm done, I'm done, I'm done, I will never, I will never. Whenever I hear that phrase, I will never, that's one of those self-limiting, narrow paths, right? Because we really don't know what's going to happen. And so this is the Dharma gate, is fully feeling that, not trying to talk ourselves out of it. No, I will love again. It's not like that. It's, oh, wait a minute. This is the end of that particular set of karmic circumstances. Now what? Now what's going to happen? Missed it, but another train is coming. Let's see where we go. And I think that's, If Bodhidharma's right, and if our teachings are also correct, that we all are Buddhas, then the opportunity is going to come up in a different form again. And we just don't know how it's going to appear. So first, but you can't just make that a mental decision. You have to feel the fullness of the despair and the hopelessness. And that's what I heard in your description. Yeah, so amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anne.
Yeah, and thank you for that, Beverly. I felt the same often. You used the word still point a couple times, or the words, and I think I came to practice craving a still point, however I defined it in my head, and I'm not sure how I defined it. And coming to realize there is no such thing, not only because my blood's moving around and all that, but it feels like on a scale of vastness, there's movement even in vastness. You'll never get to it. And that's, in some ways, it's painful. It's like the minute you get something, it's going to move on beyond you. So I cringe when I hear the point, the word still point, because it means something to me that doesn't exist.
Well, but what if the still point is the point of movement? Right, I want to challenge you around words. What if there is, of course, electrons moving, quarks, possibilities, no stillness, but maybe it's slowing down. Maybe it's not an absolute thing, but can we slow down to appreciate this coming and going? You know, I hope your heart does not stop moving soon. But maybe it's a different relationship. Maybe I don't have to chase everything. Maybe I can receive coming and going. We're never astray. So I would just encourage you to have a bigger, you will never control it. It will never be a thing you have, but maybe some new way to enter in.
And also, you know, I the strength of the word cringe reveals itself as a Dharma entry point, just like the hopelessness or the word emptiness or the idea of purity, all these things that make us go, ugh, or what, or whatever they are. That's where we have to enter. We cannot use the mind to figure these things out. So, you know, for me, still point might be a fraction of a second. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but you know, to find your way into it through owning and honoring your own feeling of cringing. Cringing was what one of the words that David's teacher, George Bowman, used to use a lot. You know, he would call it the cringe. He made it into a noun because it's a very strong feeling that has a lot of energy in it. And we don't want to turn away from that energy. We don't want to turn away from Beverly's despair or Jenny's wrongness around the word emptiness or my wrongness around the word purity. We want to enter there. That where it's strongest, where it's most vivid. So that's our challenge to you, I think. Yeah. Thank you, Anne. Brad.
Thank you, Melissa. Listening to koans, it's my approach to enter into, as you said, the different personalities or even objects and things. And the one that is striking me now is Bodhidharma's apparent resistance to returning, like you could get the whole country to go there, and he's still not coming back. I like Steve's interpretation, like the movement's passed on, so just get over it and do the next thing. But I still like there's something there's some juice there for me about his I'm imagining he would be that way. He and it's not just because he's already done a lot of walking. And what I think is that saying, you can't do it yourself and no one can do it for you. Like the second half of that is what I think of applies here. Like Wu, don't expect Bodhidharma to come back and suddenly help you get it, you know, something like that.
That's great.
I want to circle back to where Madhu started us, people asking about, well, what is it you do? What is Zen and what rank are you? Bodhidharma quite wonderfully didn't hang around. He didn't feel he had to make sure the emperor understood what he was doing. I think a lot of times we want to justify ourselves and we want to make sure, well, let me tell you, this really is important to me and da da da. So we can offer something. There are no ranks. It's just this moment. But there is something about taking responsibility. It's not our job to convince other people that Buddhism and that Zen is really wonderful. Most people are not going to be convinced. But we can live in a way. We can be alive and appreciate that. And sometimes moving on is so important. And to, yeah, let's trust next thing appearing. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks, Brad. Somebody at the temple.
I feel very impressed by all the characters for different reasons. And I was going to say something about the last line, but it sounds like it's been talked about a lot. But I also, I don't know, I was just trying to figure out which character pulls at me the most right now. I'm not sure, maybe Bodhidharma, and just how true he's being, I guess, or how, I don't know how to put it into words, but that's what I guess is impressive. But I'm impressed by all the characters for different reasons.
Mm.
Yeah, I think to appreciate, you know, we get to be, we are all of these, and Bodhidharma's courage and clarity, and in a sense, a kind of generosity. He wasn't holding back, but he also wasn't currying favor. He wasn't trying to make sure someone else approved of him. He was residing in some truth that he knew and willing to share it, also willing to meet whatever moment and go where he needed to go. And we all are Bodhidharma. You are Bodhidharma, coming for 3 days, you know, going to Doksan, meeting the emperor, you know, all of these ways. We are doing this right now. Yeah.
Thank you. And Marcus, let you be the last one.
Thank you for the talk. I think similar to, it's been brought up a couple times, but what arose for me was just, even if I felt the emperor knew who he was speaking with, you know, he could have come back 2, 3, 4, 5 times. And I think the outcome would have been the exact same because of the belief of what he envisioned something to be. And I think, you know, it was similar to what Madhu said. I spoke to, you know, a few of my siblings the last couple of days. And it's funny, everyone has the belief of, you know, I'm going to Sashin this weekend and everyone, oh, it's got to be so relaxing. And boy, that would be great. I'd love to do that. And it seems the same thing. It's the belief. And I think the disappointment in reality of, okay, we'll attend it. And I hope that is your experience, but.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love this, Marcus, because you're really pointing to how much we hold tight, how we cling to our beliefs, you know, whatever they're about. And your siblings thinking, you know, well, retreat, that sounds pretty relaxing. You can't talk them out of that. That's been my experience. Oh, you're so lucky, Melissa. You get to go on retreats all the time because the image of a retreat is such and such. And the emperor had this image of what Buddhism was. And we have to see this in ourselves. What are we clinging to? What's our belief that we hold so dearly that we don't want it to go away? It somehow helps us stay present somehow. You know, it's a mystery, really. You know, we've talked a lot recently about that cartoon about the guy sinking to the bottom of the ocean, holding onto a big stone. And he says, my stone, what would I do without my stone? These things are pulling us down to the depths, but also pulling us down to the depths, not necessarily a negative thing. So everything we encounter is the Buddha Dharma, and that's the entry point. So people thinking a retreat is a wonderful thing, great. People wanting to know what rank modu is, great. You know, that's where we enter. And our own feelings, you know, of whatever it is, confusion, despair, disgust, whatever it is, that's the entry point with ourselves. We have to see this in ourselves and with other people. This is how we stay awake and alive.
And there's a less pessimistic reading of this too, Marcus, that the emperor got everything he needed from that interview. So it doesn't need to happen again and again. Not that he's always stuck, but that he has enough now. And in fact, we all have enough.
Yeah. And I love that, Alan, connecting that back to what Beverly was saying, right? That if that's really true, that's kind of mind-blowing in a really positive way. What if everything that's ever happened to us, all these awful things and wonderful things, just right, just right, just right, and now off we go. That's what we're going to do right now. Off we go. So coming back to our upright sitting postures and waiting for the bell to take us to the next piece of formal practice.